Hello, my name is Bart, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And, it's funny, it seems like I move a lot, because each time I've been speaking lately, it would say I'm from New York, New York, or Queens, New York, and I think tonight it said Garden City, New York, but I'm proudly lately from Sedona, Arizona, and hope staying in Arizona, and seeing the passion that is here for AA and carrying the message into the prisons is another good reason to stay in Arizona. Because there are so many alcoholics in AA, or in prison, I should say, for reason of the results of alcoholism. I know for myself, I don't think that I was necessarily, I know I wasn't a bad person or a criminal, or I was an alcoholic, and the results of my alcoholism drove me to do lots of things that I wouldn't have done. So I'm really grateful for the passion of carrying the message into the prisons. And I got to watch people in prison recover from alcoholism and carry the message. And that's an absolute miracle. My sober date is June 12, 1995. And my home group currently is the Jaywalkers group in Sedona. And it's a new group, 3 weeks. And The purpose of the group, Tara and I decided, Tara, as they say in here in Arizona, is to bring the big book alive to AA and study it together. We need to continue to learn what's in that book. And we found a good group of people that are getting involved in it, and we really hope that as the group grows, we can start to, you know, get people to volunteer for their own recovery as well as to carry the message into the prisons. You know, it's so important. So, a little bit about myself. I don't know how it is in Arizona, but I know in New York it's a little controversial to say you're a recovered alcoholic. And I do that for two reasons and three possible tonight. One is to give hope to the alcoholic who still suffers. To be in recovery from anything is pretty painful. I've recovered from leg surgery, from back surgery, from alcoholism. All of those things, the process of recovery is painful, and you don't have to be in pain forever. You can recover. The second reason is not only to bring it to you, but to remind myself. Because I came into AA for the first time in 1987, and I didn't recover till 1995. And how it works, it says that those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And from 87 to 95, I wouldn't give myself to this program, so I couldn't recover. In 95, I was desperate enough. I met somebody kind and loving enough to explain what alcoholism really is, to hit my bottom and be willing to do the simple thing, which is go to any length, which is those 12 steps, traditions, and concepts, to recover from alcoholism. And I did. And what a miracle. And the third reason tonight is just to let people know that are an alcoholic that we do get better. And you can trust what we do here in AA. Miracles happen here. People who did horrible things as a result of alcoholism can recover from alcoholism and become amazing citizens. I see it all the time. So now I'll tell you a little about myself. My personality is to be extremely, extremely shy. One of the miracles of God in these steps is that I could sit up here and share with you. From 87 to 95, hanging around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had friends that would offer me $20 on a regular basis. Bart, I'll give you 20 bucks. Just raise your hand and say your name. Couldn't do it. Not a chance. Today with God in my life, you can't shut me up. There's people in New York that'll pay $100 to shut me up. But that's not going to happen either. I grew up in Queens, New York, some apartment buildings. And I'd look out the window and I'd see the older guys drinking on the corner, passing the bottle and having a whole lot of fun. And I was probably about 10 years old when I started watching them. I couldn't wait to be just like them and hang out with them. By the time I was in fifth grade, I was a little punk hanging out with them, passing the bottle around, being a complete fool and doing stupid things. And I felt like I had arrived. I don't know why those were my heroes, but those were my heroes. A little odd thinking, I guess, but what could I tell you? I guess there's a lot of people here that could probably relate to it. Fifth grade, the teachers would say, when we go out to the schoolyard for lunch, do not go on that side of the yard. That's where the bad people are. Stay on this side of the yard. And, of course, I would sneak over to that side of the yard and hang out with those people. And a lot of those times I would get a little buzzed and I wouldn't go back into school. So I started getting in trouble already in fifth grade from drinking. And my parents were moving to another neighborhood, and the end of school came, and I wasn't getting promoted because of what I was doing in school. And my parents went up to the school, and they begged, and they said, you know, we're moving, and he's going to start a new life. And they agreed to give me another shot and promote me. And I spent, when we moved, it was just to the other side of, you know, not far away. It was close enough that every day through the summer I could ride my bicycle to the old neighborhood and continue to hang out and drink. And, you know, so I met no new friends in the new neighborhood because I was going every day to the old neighborhood to drink and hang out there. First day of school came and I was scared to death because I'm shy and I didn't go into a new school, meeting nobody that I know. Having trying to meet new friends. My parents had a little closet at the front door, and it had liquor in it. And I went into the closet, and I took a few swigs of some of the liquor in there, and I felt a little calmness, and I went to school for the first day, and I got through it. Being that it worked the first day, it worked the second day, too. And then it worked the third day, and I just continued to do it, and I started to meet some people that liked to party. And I started to get into a lot of trouble in that school because of my drinking. And there was a woman who came from a place called Project 25. And once a week, I had to go see this woman and talk about the trouble that I get into school and my drinking. And the second threat in my life came. And that was that if you continue to get in trouble in this school, if you get caught with liquor on your breath, if you get caught with liquor in your locker, if we find you behind the handball courts instead of in class, you're going to be a full-time student in Project 25 and taken out of this school. Well, didn't want to get thrown out of the school. I finally found friends. But I didn't want to quit drinking either because I liked it. It made me feel good. So I got caught one more time. I got into a suspension hearing. My mom came to the suspension hearing. I was buzzed because I was scared to death, so I made sure I got pretty buzzed. Mr. Ludvack, the assistant principal, told me to get off my ass and listen to him, and I didn't like being talked to like that, so I stood up, put my hands around his throat, and I got thrown out and put into Project 25 as a full-time student. Second consequence of drinking. Well, in Project 25, all that really happened there was my parents learned to stop putting up with my shenanigans, that they didn't have to live with me as an animal and as what I was, things I was doing. And so the next time I got into trouble and I got arrested, because I was getting arrested once in a while for the things I was doing, my mom said, lock him up, he's an animal, take him. And off to Spofford, I went. And so now I started to become a real part of the court system. Every time I got into trouble, you know, I was out of Project 25 already, and now I'm going to court cases. I'm living in shelters in Brooklyn. I'm sneaking out the window of the shelters, and I'm going and drinking night train with the bums and sneaking back in. They're trying to put me on clothes restrictions, and I'm running out because you're not putting me with these people in, you know, pajamas or whatever. And I would show up for court. And I started becoming a real part of the system. You know, six-week places, three-month places, nine-month places. The last place I went was for 18 months, upstate New York. And while I was upstate New York, you know, another thing that's real important to mention is, you know, our big book talks about frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. And I loved my parents to death. I mean, you know, at the time, you know, they were great parents when I was first starting to drink. And I had a sister who died young. And I could still envision my mom standing at the front door, 120 pounds soaking wet, begging me, please don't leave this house. I don't want to lose another child. And I would physically pick her up and throw her away from the door and go out and disappear for days. And then she would either get the phone call from the precinct, or I'd come home a bloody mess, or somebody would call and say, we found Bart here, laid out in the street, come and get him. You know, those are the things that I put her through, begging, please, I don't want to lose another child, all for my desire, my obsession to drink. So I was at this place upstate for 18 months. And while I was at this place, I started to think about what's going on, how many birthdays and how many holidays I'm missing, being locked up and not with my family, and all the rest of the family is getting together, and, you know, or friends are all celebrating birthdays, and I'm in these places. So I made a decision, a pact with myself, that when I get out of Hawthorne, I'm not going to drink the way I used to, and I'm not going to get in any more trouble, and I'm going to do the right thing. So I came home after the 18 months, went to high school for the first day of school, was called into the dean's office. Dean took out some pieces of paper, my records, I guess, took a look at them, and he said, Bart, we don't want your trouble here. We're going to be watching you, and if you get into any trouble here, you're out of this school. Well, I still had a pretty bad chip on my shoulder, so I got up and I walked out. I went home and I said to my mom, you know, they're not giving me half a chance in this school. You know, they're going to be watching me like a hawk. And, you know, I've been locked up for so many years in these institutions. I'm really not going to do well in school anyway. Can I call my dad and ask him to let me come work for him? He was a fairly successful businessman. And my parents had split up. And she said, see what your father says, call him. So I called my dad and I said, you know, sign me out of school, I'll come work for you. And he said, well, I'll talk to my partners, you know, I'll talk to your mom, see what she says. If she says it's all right, I'll talk to my partners. And everybody got together and decided that I can drop out of school and come work for him. Well, first day of work came. It was a cold New York October morning, and I woke up feeling like I had arrived. I am going to change my entire life. I'm going to make everybody proud of me. I'm going to be a working man, you know. And I stood at the bus stop, feeling on top of the world, excited about the first day at work. Wasn't really that nervous. My father owned the business. It wasn't a store that he owned, you know, that he worked at. But, you know, I felt pretty confident I could do this. And a friend of mine came over and gave me a little birthday present. It was the week of my birthday. He gave me a little bottle of Jack Daniels. And I put it in my coat, and I said, this weekend I'm going to celebrate my birthday, and then I'm a working man. And the bus wasn't coming that quick, and I started getting cold. So I took a little sip, warm the bones. Now I started getting a little nervous on the bus. Once I was on the bus, I started to get a little nervous about the first day of work, and I know exactly what would calm my nerves. So I finished off that little bottle of Jack Daniels. I walked into work for the first day, and I made a complete fool of myself and of my father. And that was not my intention. I had all intentions of doing the right thing and not drinking, and I couldn't pull it off. And I didn't know it back then, but that was, and sometimes they talk about passing that invisible line. I don't know if it's an invisible line or not, but I do know that I didn't have the choice whether to drink or not that day. I couldn't reason my way through it, because that was the best reason in the world to not drink, and I did. Things started to get pretty bad for a long time after that. From then all the way to 1987, going back and forth working for him, constantly letting my family down for my drinking, picking myself up, promising it's going to be different this time. Checking myself into treatment centers, couldn't pull it off. 1987, I was living in Queens Village, New York. There was a house that some brothers owned, and nothing good went on at this house. We all own motorcycles. None of them ever left the garage. There wasn't a person that lived in the neighborhood that would not cross the street before they came by this house. One of the brothers that owned the house was showing up in the morning, going into the garage with some new friends, and getting on his bike and taking off. And one morning I went over to him and I said, "Warren, what's going on? Where you been going?" "No, I have to get my life together. You guys do what you want, but I've been going to AA." And I laughed at him and I said, "That's nice." And I went about my drinking with everybody else. But I really liked Warren. He was a great guy. We were really good friends. Every once in a while in the mornings we'd show up, or the evenings we'd show up, any chance I had, I'd still talk to Warren. And he kept planting a seed and I didn't know it. One morning I woke up feeling horrible, feeling that guilt, remorse, and shame. And I called Warren and I said, "You know what? I think I'd like to go to one of those meetings with you tonight." And he said, "I'm not going to a meeting tonight, but I'll tell you what. There's a meeting at this high school in Jackson Heights. Why don't you go over to it? People accept you there. They'll know you're new. They'll make you feel comfortable. If you really want to get sober, go to that meeting." All right. So I struggled through the day. Got to the meeting early. Paced around the school trying to figure out how to get into this meeting. Guy comes over to me and he says, "You looking for the AA meeting?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Come with me. I'm setting it up." So I walked into the school with him, just followed behind him like a little puppy, lost. He went into the classroom, and he starts putting these shades up and fixing chairs up and putting pamphlets out, and I'm just watching him. And he's real busy, and he walks over to me, and he hands me this little blue card, and he says, "What, would you like to read this?" And I said, "Sure." So I sat there as the room is filling up. Now I can't look anybody in the eye. So I had something to focus on. And I just kept sitting there and reading this blue card over and over and pretending that I was reading this blue card over and over. And he started the meeting and he said, "To read the AA preamble, we have bought." And my heart jumped out of my toes. I didn't know he meant read it out loud. I just thought he gave me something to read. So I sat there for what probably felt like 5 hours. But I guarantee it was under 5 minutes, figuring out how I'm sneaking out of this meeting and going to drink myself to death. Because if that's what you have to do in AA, to speak out loud, it ain't for me. So I walked out of the meeting and I got totally lost in the school. I figured I was going to jail tonight for trespassing. And you know, just all kinds of delusions are going through my head. I found my way back to the classroom where the meeting was. And I leaned out on outside the meeting on the wall. And I figured that when the meeting's over, I'll just follow everybody and go home and drink myself to death. And you guys surrounded me when the meeting was over. I had 1,000 reasons why I couldn't go back to the diner with you, but you wouldn't accept one. I don't know what they do here, but in New York, it's really popular. And that's why I gained most of the weight here in Arizona doing nothing. But early AA, I gained a lot of weight, too, because that's what they did. They went to meetings and went to the diner. Went to the diner before the meeting, went to the meeting, went to the diner. So, and I don't drink coffee, so I had to have ice cream or something, you know. And, I'm probably one of the few in AA that doesn't drink coffee, but I never drank it to sober up. Why was I going to start when I got here? So it's just one habit I never picked up. I hung around the meetings. I listened. I wouldn't do anything. I had a really bad attitude. People would suggest come early and make coffee. I don't drink coffee, so why am I going to make it? Well, you know, you could smoke in the meetings back then. Well, what about cleaning up ashtrays? Now, why flick mine in the street? Why doesn't everybody else just do that? You know, I mean, that was my thinking. You know, so I wasn't getting much better. And every once in a while, I would sneak something and still say I'm sober. The meetings would start getting less and less meetings. I joined the sober motorcycle club. They had to put the BART clause in it because, you know, you had to be active in AA. And, you know, and I would say, well, it's a program of suggestions. I'm active. I show up for your anniversary. That's active. You know, this was my thinking. And I couldn't get better. 1994 or so, late 94, I went out on a mad tear. I just, you know, pacing the floor. I had tried, you know, it's, I guess it's important, you know, that it says other methods that had failed. My whole life, I'd say, from 1977 was my first attempt of getting sober. And that was when I left that place for 18 months. That was my first thought of, well, I don't want to be sober, but I don't want to drink the way I'm drinking. That was, you know, prior to that, I just didn't want to drink. I mean, I just wanted to drink. By 77, I wanted to control my drinking. By 1987, it no longer was just a thought in my head, but really in my heart. I showed up to AA because I had enough, and I knew it in my heart that I really can't live like this anymore. But that wasn't enough either. I married a woman who was a detox nurse. That didn't work. I tried a lot of insane things, you know. I met a woman, I got married, I had a kid, I swore the kid would never see me, you know, active, and that didn't work. Left them, went out and drank. Tried lots of things to get sober, none of them worked. So late 94 or so, I went out on a mad tear. I was in a neighborhood one night that nothing good happens in. Went into a bodega that, you know, nothing goes good, nothing happens good in this bodega. And I started fighting with the guys that were in the bodega. And I'm lucky that they didn't cut me up and just throw me in the dumpster, because these were people that you really did not want to start a fight with. And somehow in this rage of arguing with them, I ended up back in a meeting with you guys. And it was a meeting I had never been at before. And I don't remember what happened that night, but I do know for some reason I continued to go back to that meeting. And I met a lot of good people at that meeting. A lot of young people who were really, really enjoying life, going out to clubs, listening to bands. And from 87 to 95, my attempts of sobriety, I couldn't do those things with anybody. I'd go to a club to listen. I love music. And I'd go to a club and I'd feel uncomfortable. We got to get out of here. You know, I want to drink. So I'm going to these clubs with these young guys and girls, and they're just having, they're getting in a mosh pit and doing all this crazy dancing and having fun. And, you know, girls in little mini skirts are coming over and offering drinks that I'd never seen before. And like, how are they doing this? So, of course, I figured they're just not as alcoholic as I am. You know, they're not really alcoholic. That's how they're doing it. So this went on for a little while, and one of them was celebrating their one-year anniversary one night. And I was sitting next to him, and he had his sponsor speaking for him. And his sponsor was absolutely hysterical, rolling around on the floor and just full of theatrics on his first step experience. And he had me laughing hysterically. And then he stood up and he started talking serious about recovery, about being recovered, about being happy, joyous, and free, about going where anybody else can go without harm, and just talking all this great stuff about being sober and loving life. And the more he had passion about loving life sober, the redder my face was getting and the angrier I was getting. And I turned around to my friend and I said, "Artie, that's your sponsor up there, right? Speaking for you?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "I think tonight you should find a new one." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I'm going to kill him." And I meant it. He had no right to lie, to say that you can be so happy and not drink. And Artie looked at me with this big grin, and he said, "Bart, I am sure he would love to talk to you." So the next day, I went to where he worked. And he had owned a store that sold, like, spiritual books and AA coins. And so you could just go there and talk to him. So that's what I did. He saw me pull up in my car. He was standing out in front of the store. And he saw me coming, and he went in the store, and he went behind the showcase because he heard I was coming to kill him. And he sat behind the case for probably about 2 hours talking about all the war stories, doing 12-step call. That's where the war stories are important. He started describing what he was like, what his drinking was like, and I was listening, and I was kicking some of my stories with him. And he started to describe the hopelessness of alcoholism a little bit more, and really getting into a little bit more detail about it. And I was listening, and I wasn't feeling too good. And about after about 2 hours, I said to him, "Well, what do I got to do?" to be the way you were describing last night. And he said, whew, man, am I glad you finally asked. He was getting tired of telling all these stories, I guess. And he said, all you got to do is read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, live it as a way of life, and you could have it too. And I got really depressed. I got really sad. I said, you know what? I've never read a book in my life. Fifth grade is really the last of my real education. Well, thanks anyway. And he wasn't scared anymore. And he grabbed me by the shoulder. And he said, I'll tell you what. I'll help you read that book. I'll help you put that into your life. And that's what we did. Showed up every day. And we went through what alcoholism was. Doctor's opinion, you know. Don't pick up the first drink, you won't get drunk. I heard that all the time. I never asked, what does that mean? I just thought you were a bunch of wise guys that you can't go right to the second. And I never was listening. Never really paid any attention. Made sense. And I actually felt really good. I thought, wow, that's all there is to it. You know, I got a physical allergy. I know I got a physical allergy. Don't pick up, I won't get drunk. We continued to read. And we started to get into those chapters like more about alcoholism. There is a solution. Started talking about this alcoholic mind, unable at certain times to, with sufficient force, play back those tapes. You know, lost the power of choice, unable to reason. Started, he had me think about times that I tried to do that without knowing it, and I knew that was me. I knew I had that alcoholic mind, and I was in trouble. And I started to cry for the first time in front of another man. I hit my bottom, learning what alcoholism is and accepting it. I admitted to my innermost self, in my gut, I felt sick, scared to death, that I was going to die an alcoholic. Because I knew, yep, that's me. I don't have a choice. I have lost the power of choice. Scared to death. Didn't believe in a God. God was never mentioned in my house. We started to read that we agnostics and learn that spiritual part, and oh, I'm really cooked. And that chapter started to really convince me that maybe there is something. I believe that he believed. I believe that guy Artie that he showed believed. So I started with God as I understand him, and that is I don't. That was my third step. But I did make that most important decision that any human being, I believe, can make. Turn my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to the care of God as I don't understand. And if it does work, you bet. If it works, if I know I am what this says, and if this work, if this higher power works, I will let anybody know. I will let this power work through me and show anybody. But I don't believe it's going to work. But I'll make this decision that if it does, I'll do that. And that was my third step experience. He handed me a pen. And he showed me how to write some inventory. And I wrote this inventory out. He sent me home to write some more. I went back and I shared this inventory with him. And I experienced that. And damn right, I was. You know, the sixth step talks about if you're not willing, then we ask God for the willingness. Well, I know today that that's a trap because as soon as you ask for the willingness, you're already willing. But you wouldn't be asking for the willingness. But I was willing because I was still desperate enough. It says in How It Works, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I know exactly why. Because if I was not desperate, I wouldn't have done those things. And my ego definitely would have built itself back up like it did from 87 constantly. And I wouldn't have done it. But I was still desperate enough. So I shared this with him. And I just said, God, have all of me, good and bad, do with me as you want, whatever it is. Made that list and went out everywhere. School teachers, wherever it needed to be done, I made amends. And I got free in that eighth step because, you know, those ninth step promises really came true for me in the eighth step. I was free as soon as I knew that I could look the world in the eye because I am willing to make amends with the world. You know, whatever it takes to not drink. My ninth step experience was that I got to watch lots of people in my life get free. They really knew that this time I was serious. They really knew that they didn't have to worry anymore. I really came to them in a sincere way that I never had before. There was a lot of people. My first wife, you know, the detox nurse, very clear, just stay out of my life. And there was a few others like that, but that's okay. I understand. I mean, if that's what it takes for them to feel safe, I totally understand. My son, on the other hand, I used to see around town in restaurants and stuff. And, you know, she was 10 years older than me. He was 10 years younger than me. And we were, and I was an abusive stepfather when I would come home drunk. And we had a pretty good relationship when I'd see him. I mean, it's not like I called him up and said, hey, you know, Tim, what's going on? You know, you want to hang out? But he had respect for me, and that was one of the big ones. My mom died, so I always say make them as quick as possible, because my mom was on the list, but it wasn't one of the first ones I got to, because she had moved to Florida, and I was on vacation, and I was going to leave the Bahamas and go to Florida to make the amends, and while I was in the Bahamas, she passed on, so I didn't get to make that amends. But I did get to make the amends to my father and make it to my mom through my father. I believe in going to the people that are closest. That's what worked for me, that you can speak to them through the people that were closest. The letters didn't cut it for me. You know, whatever works, that's just how I did it. There was one amends that I thought I would never get over, and resentment that I thought I would never get over, and that was one while I was on this path. My mom died. She was married to a horrible man, very, not physically, but mentally abusive. Because he was never physically abusive, I never really got into much confrontation with him. We would just beg my mother to leave him. But so we didn't have a good rapport. When I got to their house the day my mom died and I got to Florida, he handed me a bag. He said, this is what was your sister's that your mother had. That's what's yours. Now get out of here. And I didn't handle that very well. Kicked my way into the house, broke a lot of things. My father was screaming from across the parking lot because he wasn't going to come near me. Please, Bart, don't kill him. I got on my hands and knees and begged God not to let me kill this man, and that's why he's still alive today. You know, I caused harm, but God saved him and me. But I knew when I got back to New York and worked with my sponsor and got quiet and talked with God that I did need to make an amends to that man, because even though he said those things to me, I had no business putting my hands on him or breaking anything that belonged to him. And I got free, and I don't know if he got free or not, but I, you know, once in a while I think of him and I pray for him. Because the man to do those actions, them like myself, was sick too. So the amends process was amazing. Practicing 10, 11, and 12, it's just been an ongoing journey. You know, pausing when agitated, doubtful, asking God for the right forward direction. You know, when I'm doing that 10th step during the day, I really don't fight with people. You know, and I was a fighter. I had not only a temper, but you know, I always had to be right, or my thinking was really off. And when I'm practicing the 10th step, I get along with the world pretty well. Planning my day, reviewing my day. I was a little less than 3 months sober. And my sponsor came back to the meeting that I heard him speak at. And it was the first time he came back to that meeting. And he sat next to me. And it was a beginner's meeting on a Friday night. And there was a rehab that used to come into this meeting every Friday night. They'd take the van, they'd come to this meeting. And the speaker spoke for his 15, 20 minutes. And they opened it up to anybody new. And there was a guy that was about, I don't know, well over 6 feet tall, bald-shaved head, no teeth, completely tattooed. And all he had to say was, I hate all of yous. I want to kill all of yous. I'm no fool. The judge said it was jail or this rehab, and that's why I'm here. But I don't want to be here. And just really raging. My sponsor looked at me, and he said, after the meeting, I want you to go over to that guy and win his confidence. And I looked at him like, what are you, nuts? And it wasn't because of what he looked like, and it wasn't because he was angry. I was less than 3 months sober. What do I got to offer? And my sponsor opened up to a vision for you. He always just went back to that book. And he said, you're one man with this book in your hand, and you just tapped into a power greater than yourself. And you know what? First 11 steps were all working in my life, and I wasn't thinking of drinking. And he had told me, that nothing was going to ensure sobriety as much as intensive work with another alcoholic. And that meant now, because I wouldn't see 3 months sober probably had I not started working with others. And he hadn't lied to me yet, and that book hadn't lied to me, so I ran over to that guy before he got on the van, in the van, and I said, "Hey, how would you like a visitor on Sundays?" I knew the rehab, and it wasn't far from where I lived. "How would you like a visitor on Sundays?" He had the typical answer: "Will you bring me a sandwich?" You got it. So every Sunday, I went and brought him a sandwich and a big book. And I said, "We're going to sit here and do this, and you could eat your hero." And that's what we did. You know, he ate his sandwich, and we went through the book. And I watched this guy get out of the rehab. He had a girlfriend that was living in Philadelphia or somewhere, and she was running the streets, and they had a kid in foster care. And I watched him go back and forth from New York to there and get visitation, but, you know, where somebody watches them. And, you know, eventually he got that kid out of foster care and brought him back to New York and was a single sober dad. And I knew that this is what AA is all about. That from 87 to 95, I couldn't stay sober, and AA was really boring because I wasn't in AA. I was around AA. All those steps on the shade were written in past tense. We admitted, came to believe. Well, I didn't do any of that. You people might have, but I didn't, so I wasn't part of the we. So AA was boring. I got to tell you, 14 and a half years, AA has not been boring for me because I continue to do what that man showed me to do. You know, I went into the prisons, and, you know, I started doing a big book workshop. In New York, they had something called Nassau County Jail. They had something called the DART program. And if you had alcohol or drug history, no matter what crime it was, a lot of the guys and girls would get into this program called the DART program. And I approached the director of the DART program and asked if the night that they have Bible study in library, if any of them would like to come to a big book study where I could take them actually through the steps. But it had to be voluntary. And she agreed, and I did that for 2 years, and I watched a lot of the guys recover from alcoholism. Some of them came home, and some of them took their experience and got sentenced to upstate and would bring it and carry the message in jail. You know? So I know that this can work. My heroes are different today. You know? My sponsor, the original guy who took me through the steps, he was getting really sick. He was on kidney dialysis 3 times a week. He had diabetes, and his foot was getting amputated a little bit at a time. He was living on a hospital bed in a friend's house in Long Island, and his health wasn't really too good, but he was still carrying this message. Newcomers were still going to that house. People were sending, "Hey, go to Eric, where he's living, and he'll show you how to live." He was still carrying this message. You know, we watched. You know, every single person in AA, I believe, can be Villain Bob. Because his, I think it was his 10th anniversary. Yeah, Eric had the ego that could fill all of Tucson. I mean, but he used it to help others. You know, he was the guy that you walked into his store and he had no qualms. If you were miserable and weren't working the steps, he'd look right at you. He didn't even have to know you. And he didn't care that he'd lose the sale for the coins or whatever. He'd go, "You're going to die. Untreated alcoholism, you're going to die. You know, I got an answer, but if you don't want it, you're going to die." That's just the way he was. And it worked for him. You know, I can't carry the message like that. It's not my personality. He could carry the message like that because it was his personality. But, we had a group anniversary, a one-year group anniversary for a group, and we asked him to come speak for this one-year anniversary, and he showed up. And what they did was, when he got there, they said, "Everybody that's been sponsored by Eric, can you please stand up?" And a couple of us stood up. And they said, "Don't sit down. Everybody that's been sponsored by the people that just stood up, please stand up." A few more people stood up. And they continued to do that until everybody in the room was standing except a couple of newcomers. And that happens around every one of us. AA, the fellowship you crave, starts by every one of you. I mean, Tara and I moved to Sedona, and you know, we were used to sponsoring a tremendous amount of people in New York. You know, walking into meetings and, you know, seeing people we sponsor or people we work with, and it was intensive work with others. And that is what really keeps us connected with God and keeps us sober. And now we move into a town that we don't know anybody. And what do? So we said, you know what? We had the Jaywalkers meeting in Long Island. We'll start the Jaywalkers meeting in Sedona. And we put flyers out. And a few people that we were already working with were announcing it at meetings. Some of them a little, you know, we had to like calm them down. Oh, new style meeting. And, you know, easy. There's no advertisement. Just, you know, new meeting. And first night, you know, 20 people showed up. And they're still coming and they're asking questions. And you know, God is good. You know, pray, do the work, and they'll show up. So Eric was one of my heroes. Don Pritz was my other hero. You know, 37 years, carried the message right up to the day he died. You know, these are AAs that had unbelievable passion. You know, you guys here on a Friday night to carry the message to the alcoholic that's in the prison. You know, this is the passion that we could never lose for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, besides the fact that, you know, AA depends on it, and you know, if it stay around for our children, our grandchildren, I mean, for ourselves. I mean, I do not ever want to lose the passion that I have for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks.